This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk, famous for his intense music and wild performances. When you think of Iggy, you think of loud, fast, and maybe angry music. Songs like Search and Destroy and I Want to Be Your Dog. So what's he doing singing the Antonio Carlos Jobim bossa nova How Insensitive and the standard Autumn Leaves and an original reminiscent of early Louis Armstrong? They're all on his new CD, Preliminaire. The CD is inspired by the 2005 novel, The Possibility of an Island, by the French novelist Michel Houellebecq. The project began when Iggy was asked to write songs for a documentary about Houellebecq. Before we talk about this new direction for the 62-year-old icon, let's hear the opening track of Preliminaire, Autumn Leaves. The original French title is Les Feuilles Mortes.
Tu doucement, sans faire de bruit, et la mer effacée sur le sable, les pas des amants désunis. C'est une chanson qui nous ressemble. Toi, tu m'aimais et je t'aimais. Nous vivions tous les deux ensemble. Toi qui m'aimais.
That's Les Feuilles Mortes, The Autumn Leaves, sung by Iggy Pop from his new album, Preliminaire. Iggy Pop, welcome back to Fresh Air. I have to say, I never expected to hear you sing The Autumn Leaves. Now, I have two early associations with this song. One was, you know, in the mid-1950s, like in 1955, Roger Williams, the pianist, had a number one hit of Autumn Leaves, and it was so frilly. It was like, arpeggios every second, and
yes,
glissandos.
That's why I did it the opposite way.
Right. Then I also, when I took piano lessons as a kid, I had the sheet music, so I knew all the words. So tell me more about your original associations with the Autumn Leaves.
Well, there is that problem. However, I could recommend to you, there's a hell of a version by Little Walter.
By Little Walter, the blues?
Little Walter on chromatic harp. I heard it once somewhere. The original lyric, the lyric I'm singing, is not about an autumn leaf drifting by somebody's window, which is a lovely metaphor, but really not that heavy. No, 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 no. What the guy says is just very simply, look, this is a story. We all know it. We've all lived it. I loved you. You loved me. But then life came in, and without even much of a real fuss, the tide came in, and when the tide came out, we are separated. And people are pulled apart, whether they want to be or not. That's a heavy thing.
So I want to play what is my favorite track on the CD, and this is King of the Dogs. And the lyric really gets you, and you've got this great Louis Armstrong-ish band behind you. And of all the things I wouldn't associate with you as a performer, that this might especially be it. Iggy Pop and a clarinetist, I wouldn't have thought of it.
That's Mark Phaneuf.
He's great. The band is great.
He's a very sought after Broadway player.
Oh.
He's wonderful.
And I noticed there, after listening to it and thinking Armstrong, I noticed that Lillian Armstrong is co-credited as a songwriter. Is that Armstrong's wife, Lil Armstrong?
Yeah, Lil Hardin. Lil Hardin was her name, and then she was married to Louis for 4 years, so she uses the other name as well. Yeah, well, I was listening to him.
So she wrote the melody that you used, is that it?
Sort of. It went like this. No, actually, the sung melody and the bridge is mine, but part of the chord progression is from King of the Zulus, written by her and recorded by Louis, and I didn't know that until a couple of months after I'd written the song. And I was listening to Louis Armstrong again, because I do every few months, and I thought, oh, damn.
I see. You didn't realize that you were borrowing a line.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Nice of you to credit it. A lot of people wouldn't.
What we did, I contacted their people, and it's about, the music's about half me, half from hers. So this one progression is right out of King of the Zulus. So we split it up.
Well, let's hear King of the Dogs, and then we'll talk about it a little bit more.
Right.
So this is Iggy Pop from his new CD, Preliminaire.
Your throat if you move on me. I'm sovereign, 'cause I'm the king of the dogs. Whole life, will fill you full of cancer. I don't even own a pair of pants. I'm a dancer, baby.
King of the Dogs, Iggy Pop from his new CD, Preliminaire. Iggy Pop, like you've never heard him before.
this is true.
Tell us about the inspiration behind this song, both in terms of the band, you know, the music arrangement, and also the subject matter.
I've got one of my favorite records is something called Louis Armstrong and the Hot Fives. And I've been listening to that record for, I don't know, I bought it in 1992 when I was making a record in New Orleans. And when this came up, there's a dog named Fox who is a big part of this book. And there was footage of Welbeck auditioning little dogs. And I thought it was funny. And I have a small dog, Lucky, who's a 12-pound Maltese. He's all dog. He's got a butch attitude, but he really does. You know, he's fearless and very very strong for his size, but he's still 12 pounds. You know, and I'm sensitive to, you know, I'm sensitive to animal anthropology. If that, I suppose that's a contradiction in terms, but I enjoy watching all the things animals do that are just like the things I like to do. and such as, I don't like to wear shoes. I hate wearing clothes. I didn't even take a shower before I came over to do this interview, you know?
Thanks for telling us.
Yeah. Well, I was in the pool all day, you know?
Oh, okay.
That's close enough, you know? So, you know, I sort of wrote some from a viewpoint. There's a little bit of my own dog Lucky in there. There's a little bit of just humor from this film, and then there's a lot of me. Just, you know, sometimes I see animals and I wish I was them.
Because?
Because they're free and because they can be satisfied and happy. And that's not possible for a human being. Except maybe, you know, it's fleeting. It's harder to achieve.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Iggy Pop, and we're talking about a new CD, which is called Préliminaire, the French word préliminaire for what, preliminaries?
It's a step in a certain direction musically for me, but because it was a slim volume, I called it that. I wouldn't be forthcoming if I also didn't mention that in French it means foreplay.
Oh.
Yes. There is that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's hear another song from your new CD. And this is a very famous Antonio Carlos Jobim song called How Insensitive, another song I never expected you to sing. And it's a kind of sensitive song about being insensitive.
Yeah, it's about that moment, you know, that moment. Everybody gets it from somebody once in their life. You're really, really, really hung up on a person, and they've got to say, you know, no, I don't want to see you, don't want to touch you, don't want to be with you, not interested in you, you don't even make me laugh. Please leave me alone. It's not a nice moment, and it obliges the other to be insensitive in some sense, to hurt you without even wanting to try, you know.
So how did this song become one of the songs you chose to do?
Well, what happened in doing music for this film, I quickly sort of, it's a documentary. The footage is kind of dull. It's people talking. So my mind cast back to his novel. And in the novel, the guy is rejected by his very pretty and not much else young girlfriend. So I thought, I'd always loved this song. And something I love about it is the economy with which the lyricist sums up the entire situation in very few words, only two verses. Generally in pop writing, there's a third verse. He didn't even bother with that. It's a little over 2 minutes long, the song. So I'd always loved it, and the melody's beautiful, and it fit the occasion. So that was it.
Okay, so here's Iggy Pop singing the Jobim song, How Insensitive, from Iggy Pop's new album, Préliminaire. Iggy Pop from his new CD, Préliminaire, which is a series of songs, original and standards, inspired by the Michel Houellebecq novel, The Possibility of an Island, which Iggy Pop is a big fan of. So, you know, I don't know that your listeners have heard you sing ballads before. What does singing ballads bring out in you that you didn't show to your fans before?
Well, it's feeling, isn't it, really? And I never stopped as a listener ever in my life with one form of music. And I've been trying to express some of these things all my life, but with much less success than I did in expressing some of the ultra rock or ultra punky emotions, which are basically, look out, I'm going to rip your rip your convertible top, sort of thing. And but so people paid more attention to that. But if you look back to the first album I ever made, which was with the Stooges, there's a love ballad on it called Anne. And I actually sing the words, you know, Anne, my Anne, I love you. But at the time, it came out more like, Anne, my voice hadn't matured yet, and I couldn't really hack it. But I tried. I started then trying to fool with standards. But we didn't put any on the record for the same reason. I wasn't quite mature enough to handle them.
Now, when you say mature enough, do you mean vocally or just mature enough to kind of reveal a more emotional side through your music to your listeners?
In my case, the two together. Mm-hmm. And it's been probably the greatest personal gift of my life has been that I have a stronger voice now than I did when I was 50 or even 55. I'm 62, and it's still getting bigger.
Is that because of something you've done?
It really helped that I quit smoking at the turn of the century. And the other thing is I do something called Qigong, which is it's Chinese yoga, basically, and it's a lot about breathing. So my voice is growing. So the two things, there's that, and then there's maybe a little more musical skill, and then there's just what you've lived, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That really helps.
So what are the chances that we'll see you, like, in a cabaret playing some of the songs from your new CD?
I don't know. I'm going to do radio, live radio with an audience doing the same thing in about a week in Paris. So I'm sneaking up on it. And every time we do it, the band from the record comes with me, and we expand our repertoire a little bit to include, we're doing Cab Calloway, Minnie the Moocher.
Oh, good.
We're doing Put a Spell on You. So I'm having a ball with it. I think by the time we get back from this trip, we'll know about 16 songs. So it's possible. I tell people there's this little voice in my head going, Cafe Carlisle, Rainbow Room, Talk of the Town. You know,
that's great.
Yeah, I still won't wear a shirt.
Really?
Nah.
Not even to the Cafe Carlisle when they call.
Nah.
Because what?
Nah, because I just don't like to sing in a shirt. And when I did them on French TV, I had a beautiful suit with sparkling lapels, but I skipped the shirt, you know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Iggy Pop. The 62-year-old godfather of punk heads in a new direction on his new CD, Preliminaire. The CD is inspired by the novel The Possibility of an Island by the French writer Michel Houellebecq. It includes Iggy's version of the Antonio Carlos Jobim bossa nova How Insensitive and the standard Autumn Leaves, as well as originals. Well, I want to play another track from your new CD. Here's another original I want to play. It's called It's Nice to Be Dead. and talk about the inspiration behind the song.
Well, you know, I was able to include this because in the novel, the the neo-humans. This, basically, this guy's life is carried on after his death, so that's fine. And then myself, I just feel that there are days when I can just think, you know, boy, if I was dead, I wouldn't have to. And then I just tick off tick off the different things I wouldn't have to do. You know, oh, I wouldn't have to pretend to be a nice guy to so-and-so. Or, oh, I wouldn't have to, you know, worry about whether something I'm doing fits, is okay, am I good, you know, not bad, you know, or this or that, you know, and just the general fatigue of things. And I also sort of question, well, if there's a God, why are his followers so eh? You know, so there's some of these are some of the things that come up in the song.
Okay, so this is It's Nice to Be Dead, a
it's
song
nice
that
to be dead.
Iggy Pop co-wrote with Hal Cragen, and this is from Iggy Pop's new CD, Preliminaire.
It's nice to be dead. Nice to be understood. No need for being good. That's nice. Hey! They say
Iggy Pop from his new CD, Preliminaire, which features songs inspired by a novel by the French writer Michel Houellebecq, and the novel is called The Possibility of an Island. So that song leads me to ask, have you ever come close to dying?
I thought you were just going to ask me if I was dead yet.
Uh-uh.
yeah, sure, I have. Actually, it was funny. I thought of it during our last exchange, because I did come close a couple of times when I was a druggie, and one time I did actually hear the trumpets, the celestial choir, and all that stuff. It was pretty insipid, but yeah, a couple of times. And then I suppose there are other times that all of it, we all come close and don't know it, you know. But yeah, I've had like a couple of big car crashes, a couple of drug episodes, a couple of old gun to the head episodes, you know, that sort of thing.
And have they been transformative?
Only later. The transformation took place later when I just realized, you know, I wasn't really feeling great on a day-to-day basis. And then when I became older and had things to live for, then those potentially truly destructive experiences become they become very cautionary. So they help you in that way, you know.
He said during one of these near-death experiences, you heard the celestial choirs, and the music was insipid. Can you tell us more about what you heard? I mean, as a musician and as a punk rocker,
right.
It's kind of interesting to hear.
Well, there was some of that. It sort of sounded sounded like a Tangerine Dream album. Actually, you know, it's kind of like you know, a little bit of that, and that the music, you know, it was more of a, I don't remember the melody, but in that case, I do remember the part that wasn't insipid was that I heard my mother, who's a beautiful person, in my interior experience, I heard her calling me. And that was what brought me back into carnal territory. And as soon as I re-entered, I was in a hell of a lot of pain and discomfort.
Was this after a car crash or an OD?
This was an OD.
Was she really calling you, or was that just like a hallucination? I mean, was she just in the room with you? Or
No.
So it was just an auditory thing?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. I think she had those wishes constantly on tap for me, and it may have been. I certainly think that there are psychic connections that happen between people who know each other well, which are very everyday. And I don't question at all. So it may have been that at that moment she had a feeling that something bad was happening to me, and it triggered her to think of me, and that might have translated in my mentality to a callback. I think so.
But, you know, it's interesting because when you had this overdose, it was probably at a time when you and your mother weren't at your closest. I'm just guessing here, making an assumption.
So, no, we were never mattered.
It never mattered?
But go ahead.
Well, it's interesting that it was her voice that brought you back, that when you were like near expiring, that, you know, it was her and not your friends or even band members. It was her that brought you back to life.
Rock bands are pretty vicious aggregates of associates, and there's a certain amount of friendship, but it's not don't try this at home, kids. it's not as good as it looks, let me tell you. That was who cared for me.
Afterwards?
My mother, I mean. Just in general.
Oh, in general.
In this world, mm-hmm. You know.
My guest is Iggy Pop. His new CD is called Preliminaire. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. The last time we spoke, you said that that you didn't start being who you are until you were 21.
Yeah, in 1920, right? I was working on it, but it hit about 21. Yeah,
but I'm thinking, like, with you playing songs in this new CD that you knew before you were 21, and going back to music that's really old, if you're getting more in touch with your pre-21-year-old self,
that's an interesting and I think very fair premise observation. You've got a good point there. Does that make this my second childhood, Terry?
No, but at some point you recreate yourself when you enter adulthood, and at some point you maybe like reconcile that with the childhood that preceded it. And
I think you got a real good point there. Yeah.
So in what way is that happening to you? And how do you think it's changing you?
Well, I had never thought about it, but if since you brought it up and we're sitting here talking about it, I could say one thing about kids that I notice is they're more open and vulnerable. And this music, the sort of place you have to go to write and sing things like this, is a more open and vulnerable place than the sort of place I would go to do the rock albums I've done, mm-hmm. which are more, those are basically, those are about attack. I don't know. Those are things that come to mind off the top of my head. Haven't heard what you had to say. It's not bad.
But I'm thinking, too, of just, you know, maybe at some point, you know, when you've recreated yourself, you don't want to be in touch with the person who preceded that. You have to work so hard to become the new person.
Well, that's true. And then at some point, you just are.
Right.
You just are. And other people do it for you. and then it pisses you off, that happens. Then you're having dinner with somebody, and they, you're having a good time, and then they've got to blow it, like, oh, I'm having dinner with Iggy Pop, or whatever, So I think it was Bob Dylan who said somewhere, he said, somebody reminds me who I am, and that just kills it, and I know what he's saying, So there's some of that too, and then, you do create a bit of a monster, but I don't want to veer into George Michael territory here, where I'm going to whine about, I can't walk down the street without somebody loving me. look, buddy, or whatever it is, Oh, boy, so.
Did your parents ever like your music?
Well, now that you ask, I never heard a good comment about the musical content from either of them, unless it was some of the things that I did that were preliminary to preliminary. So when they got much older, and I did a little bit of ballad work here and there, one-offs, movie, usually for films. They enjoyed that and would mention it, my voice. Mm-hmm. But my father thought that a lot of the lyrics were of quality, and said, he would say, that's poetry, that was about it. And my mom was just sort of, I think she, at one point she would say, she was, I'm very proud of his physique. my dad would tell me that. Your mother's very proud of your physique. so they liked what I did, but I never really heard them, telling me, like, boy, on Give Me Some Skin, that 200 beat a minute, beat speed metal by 15 years. No, I never heard that one,
I'd like to end by just paying tribute to Ron Ashton, who was, the guitarist. Sure. In your band for many years, and he died at the very beginning of this year, and I'm not even certain how he died. I read the obits before the autopsy, and I'm not sure what they finally found.
This natural cause is heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that his blood pressure wasn't being treated properly. He liked to put things off, and he'd had a nosebleed on our last tour, and got a very high BP diagnosis from a French doctor who gave him medication. And my guess is, I believe that he hadn't gotten around to renewing the prescription with an American doctor. That might have saved him. I certainly feel that he died sooner than he needed to, but he was at the top of his game. And He went out in good form.
It's funny. I mean, he was the member of the band who didn't do drugs and didn't flirt with death by doing drugs.
Well, there is that. There is that. He was more everyday, more of an everyday sort of a guy.
So would it be too personal to ask what effect it had on you to when he died?
I still don't know what effect. I'm still trying to figure that out. Some days I feel bad. Some days I'm mad at him. Some days I'm mad at people around him. Some days, we go through life and we don't really get to know that many people. And I knew him and he knew me. So that in and of itself, I lost him in the year before that, my father. And those were two of the last people that I felt knew me very, very well. So there's that too. I feel a couple steps closer to space travel right now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So different things. I was happy for him that he was, as I said, he was playing very, very, very well. And he was, he'd become a great live field general. And he could move, he and his brother together, when they would lock a groove, they could move as many people as you put in front of them. So they were moving some very large crowds, and it really was a remarkable groove.
The Stooges had gotten back together again. You even released an album together in 2007. Had Ron Ashton not died, do you think that you would have stayed together?
Yes, absolutely. We would have continued indefinitely as a group. And although the Stooges, that's over, there is still Iggy and the Stooges. And James Williamson and I are talking about possibly picking up where we left off after Raw Power and Kill City. And Scott, Ron's brother, is very, very keen to play. So there is that.
Well, Iggy Pop, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Terry, and it's been the same.
Iggy Pop's new CD is called Preliminaire. Here's one of his punk classics, I Want to Be Your Dog, with the late Ron Ashton on guitar. From Teddy Roosevelt to John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush, every president has tried to fix a brand on his domestic agenda. Now, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg, it's President Obama's turn.
Teddy Roosevelt had his square deal. Franklin Roosevelt had his new deal. LBJ had his great society. And now Barack Obama is aiming to create a new foundation. The president introduced the phrase in passing in his inaugural address, and lately he's been working it into just about every speech to link his programs for energy, education, health care, and financial reform. I can see why the speechwriters would have liked the phrase, with its suggestion of sound investment, not to mention the allusion to the parable from the Sermon on the Mount about building your house on rock rather than sand. But of course, some people had their quibbles. New foundation has too many syllables, its meaning isn't obvious, it's the same slogan Jimmy Carter briefly floated in 1979, it makes you think of a girdle. That might all be relevant if new foundation were being offered as a slogan, like change we can believe in. The word slogan comes from the Gaelic for battle cry, if you'll cast your mind back, and slogans still live and die by language. They work for as long as they're vivid and fresh, and as soon as they get stale, they have to be replaced. Goodbye, things go better with Coke. Hello, it's the real thing. But phrases like the New Deal and the Great Society aren't slogans. They're more akin to brand names like Kellogg's or General Electric, which gather a bunch of different items into a single product line. The actual phrases aren't that important. Even when a brand name starts out with an independent meaning, it only becomes successful when its original connotations are eclipsed by the aura of the thing it's attached to. People don't buy a maiden form so they can achieve the form of a maiden, or shop at Safeway because it's safe. And if you're torn between buying a cougar and a jaguar, It's not because you can't decide which cat you like the best. In politics, though, slogans can occasionally turn into brand names as their original meanings fade. Take the New Deal, which only accidentally became a slogan in the first place. After the Democrats chose FDR as their nominee at the convention in Chicago in 1932, he decided at the last minute to break with tradition and accept the nomination in person. When he arrived after a 9-hour charter flight from Albany, his speechwriter Sam Rosenman handed him a speech that contained the ringing line, "I pledge you, I pledge myself, to a new deal for the American people." It wasn't intended as a campaign slogan, but the next day a cartoonist depicted a poor farmer looking up at an airplane labeled New Deal, and the phrase caught on. It wasn't novel. New Deal was an old term for a fresh start, originally derived from poker. At the time, that metaphor was still very vivid. FDR's opponent Herbert Hoover ridiculed the New Deal as no more than a new shuffle. And just after the election, a columnist wrote, "We not only got a new deal and a new dealer, but a new deck of cards." An editorial cartoon entitled Hope showed FDR about to deal a deck of cards. Another, more foreboding, showed him with a deck topped by a bearded, bomb-throwing joker labeled Socialist Experiments. To a desperate country, the slogan New Deal promised dramatic changes, even if FDR's actual campaign platform was vague and not especially radical. It was only after the new administration enacted a torrent of legislation during its first 100 days that the phrase grew capital letters and was transformed from a slogan to a proper name for FDR's programs. From then on, its original meaning began to fade. In modern times, almost nobody associates the deal of the New Deal with cards. Most people assume it refers to an agreement or compact with the American people. That transition from campaign slogan to proper name has never fully repeated itself. After Kennedy's election, his New Frontier slogan became a label for his administration's youthful style. But by the time his legislative proposals were brought to fruition, they were wearing the brand of Johnson's Great Society. And since then, presidents have had very little luck at branding their agendas. Neither Nixon nor Reagan got anywhere with a new federalism. Clinton's New Covenant was blown out in the early innings by Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, which fared better. And George W. Bush's Ownership Society went down with his proposals to privatize Social Security. Though you could argue that Bush's real marketing triumph was in bundling an assortment of far-flung military operations and domestic security programs under the brand name War on Terror. History's judgment on these things doesn't depend on what they're called. If we still remember the Great Society, it certainly isn't because of its name, which sounded terribly inflated when it was first proclaimed. It's because, like the New Deal, it encompassed a sweeping legislative program that transformed American life. We'd remember it just as well if it had been called the Sensational Nation, or a Better Deal, which was the name that Johnson actually tried out first. And the fate of Obama's new foundation will ultimately depend on politics, not syllables or semantics. In fact, we'll know for sure it's a success when people can't remember why it was called that anymore. Obama was right when he said in the campaign that words matter, but names matter a little less.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist and the author of the new book, The Years of Talking Dangerously. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhevar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.